1. Scion of Terror. Colossae. Rebel Moon. Cyclopean Magnus. Rogel Dawn. Leman Russ. Names that rang with history. Names that shaped history. Her eyes roamed further up the list. Korax. Night Haunter. Angron. And so on through a legacy of heroism and conquest. Of worlds reclaimed in the name of the Emperor as part of the ever-expanding Imperium of Man. It thrilled her just to hear the names in her head. But greater than any of them was the name at the top of the list. Horus, the War Master. Lupercal, she heard his soldiers now called him, an affectionate nickname for their beloved commander. It was a name earned in the fires of battle, on Ulanor, on murder, on 6319, a world the deluded inhabitants had, in their ignorance, known as Terror. And a thousand other battles she had not yet committed to her mnemonic implants. The thought that she was so very far from the sprawling family estates of Kairos, and would soon set foot on the vengeful spirit to record living history, took her breath away. But she was here to do more than simply record history unfolding. She knew, deep in her soul, that Horus was history. She ran a hand through her long, midnight black hair, swept up in a style considered chic in the Terran court. Not that anyone this far out in space would know, allowing her fingernails to trace a path down her smooth, unblemished skin. Her olive-skinned features had been carefully moulded by a life of wealth and facial sculpting to be regal and distinguished, with just the fashionable amount of aloofness crafted into the proud sweep of her jawline. Tall and striking, she sat at her maplewood escritoire, a family heirloom her father proudly boasted had been a gift from the Emperor to his great-great-grandmother after the great oath-taking in the Urals. She tapped on her data slate with a gold-tipped Nemo quill, its reactive nib twitching in response to her excitement. Random words crawled across the softly glowing surface, the quill's organic stem crystals picking up the surface thoughts from her frontal lobes. Crusade. Hero. Savior. Destroyer. She smiled and erased the words with a swipe of an elegantly manicured nail, the edge smoothed down to the fractal level, and began to write with pronounced cursive sweeps of the quill. It is with great heart and a solemn sense of honor that I, Petronella Viva, Palatina Maioria of House Carpinus, do pen these words. For many a long year I have journeyed from Terror, enduring many travails and inconveniences. Petronella frowned and quickly erased the words she had written, angry at having copied the unnatural affectedness that so infuriated her in the remembrance of scripts that had been sent back from the leading edge of the Great Crusade. Cinderman's texts in particular irritated her, though of late they had become few and far between. Dion Fraster produced some passable symphonics, nothing that would enjoy more than a day or so of favour in the Terran ballrooms, but pleasing enough. And the landscapes of Keelan Roger were certainly vibrant, but possessed a hyperbole of brushstrokes that she felt was unwarranted. Ignace Carcassi had written some passable poems, but they painted a picture of the Great Crusade she often thought unflattering to such a wondrous undertaking, especially blood through misunderstanding. And she often asked herself why the War Master allowed him to pen such words. She wondered if perhaps the subtexts of the poetry went over his head, and then laughed at the thought that anything could get past one such as Horus. She sat back on her chair and placed the quill in the lathe well, as a sudden, treacherous doubt gnawed at her. She was so critical of the other remembrances, but had yet to test her own mettle amongst them. Could she do any better? Could she meet with the greatest hero of the age, a god, some called him, although that was a ridiculous, outmoded concept these days, and achieve what they had, in her opinion, singularly failed to do? Who was she to believe that her paltry skill could do justice to the mighty tales the War Master was forging, hot on the anvil of battle? Then she remembered her lineage, and her posture straightened. Was she not of House Carpinus, finest and most influential of the noble houses in Terran aristocracy? Had not House Carpinus chronicled the rise of the Emperor and his domain throughout the Wars of Unification, watching it grow from a planet-spanning empire to one that was even now reaching from one side of the galaxy to the other to reclaim mankind's lost realm? As though seeking further reassurance, Petronella opened a flat blotting folder with a monogrammed leather cover and slid a sheaf of papers from inside it. At the top of the pile was a picked image of a fair-haired Astartes in burnished plate, kneeling before a group of his peers as one of them presented a long, trailing parchment to him. Petronella knew that these were called oaths of moment, vows sworn by warriors before battle to pledge their skill and devotion to the coming fight. An intertwined EK device in the corner of the Pict identified it as one of Euphrates Keeler's images, and though she was loath to give any of the remembrancers credit, this piece was simply wondrous. Smiling, she slid the Pict to one side to reveal a piece of heavy-grained cartridge paper beneath. The paper bore the familiar double-headed eagle watermark, representing the union of the Mechanicum of Mars and the Emperor, and the script was written in the short, angular strokes of the sigillite's hand, the quick pen strokes and half-finished letters speaking of a man writing in a hurry. The upward slant to the tails of the high letters indicated that he had a great deal on his mind, though why that should be so, now that the Emperor had returned to Terra, she did not know. She smiled as she studied the letter for what must have been the 100th time since she had left the port at Gyptus, knowing that it represented the highest honour accorded to her family. A shiver of anticipation travelled along her spine as she heard far distant klaxons and a distorted automated voice coming from the gold-rimmed speakers in the corridor outside her suite declared that her vessel had entered high anchor around the planet. She had arrived. Petronella pulled a silver sash beside the escritoire, and, barely a moment later, the door chime rang and she smiled, knowing without turning that only Maggard would have answered her summons so quickly. Though he never uttered a word in her presence, nor ever would, thanks to the surgery she'd had the family chaperones administer, she always knew when he was near by the agitated jitter of her nemo-quill as it reacted to the cold steel bite of his mind. She spun around in her deeply cushioned chair and said, "Open." The door swung smoothly open, and she let the moment hang as Maggard waited for permission to stand in her presence. "I give you leave to enter," she said, and watched as her dour bodyguard of 20 years smoothly crossed the threshold into her frescoed suite of gold and scarlet. His every move was controlled and tight, as though his entire body, from the hard, sculpted muscles of his legs to his wide, powerful shoulders, was in tension. He moved to the side as the door shut behind him, his dancing golden eyes sweeping the vaulted filigreed ceiling and the adjacent anterooms in a variety of spectra for anything suspect. He kept one hand on the smooth grip of his pistol, the other on the grip of his gold-bladed Curlian rapier. His bare arms bore the faint scars of augmetic surgery, pale lines across his dark skin, as did the tissue around his eyes where house chirurgeons had replaced them with expensive biometric spectral enhancers to enable him better to protect the scion of House Carpinus. Clad in gold armor of flexing rigid bands and silver mail, Maggard nodded in unsmiling acknowledgement that all was clear, though Petronella could have told him that without all his fussing. But since his life was forfeit should anything untoward befall her, she supposed she could understand his caution. "Where is Babeth?" asked Petronella, slipping the sigillite's letter back into the blotter and lifting the nemo-quill from the leathwell. She placed the nib on the data slate and cleared her mind, allowing Maggard's thoughts to shape the words his throat could not, frowning as she read what appeared. "She has no business being asleep," said Petronella. "Wake her. I am to be presented to the mightiest hero of the Great Crusade, and I'm not going before him looking as though I've just come from some stupid pilgrim riot on Terra. Fetch her, and have her bring the velveteen gown, the crimson one with the high collars. I'll expect her within 5 minutes." Maggard nodded, and withdrew from her presence, but not before she felt the delicious thrill of excitement, as the nemo-quill twitched in her grip and scratched the last few words on the data slate. "Ing, bitch." In one of the ancient tongues of Terra, its name meant Day of Wrath. and Jonah Arukan knew that the name was well deserved. Rearing up before him like some ancient god of a forgotten time, the Deus Irae stood as a vast monument to war and destruction, its armoured head staring proudly over the assembled ground crew that milled around it like worshippers. The Imperator-class Titan represented the pinnacle of the Mechanicum's skill and knowledge, the culmination of millennia of war and military technology. The Titan had no purpose other than to destroy, and had been designed with all the natural affinity for the business of killing that mankind possessed. Like some colossal armored giant of steel, the Titan stood 43 meters tall on crenellated bastion legs, each one capable of mounting a full company of soldiers and their associated supporting troops. Jonah watched as a long banner of gold and black was unfurled between the Titan's legs, like the loincloth of some feral savage, emblazoned with the death's head symbol of the Legio Mortis. Scores of curling scrolls, each bearing the name of a glorious victory won by the Warmaster, were stitched to the honor banner, and Jonah knew that there would be many more added before the Great Crusade was over. Thick, ribbed cables snaked from the shielded power cores in the hangar's ceiling towards the Titan's armored torso, where the mighty war engine's plasma reactor was fed with the power of a caged star. Its adamantine hull was scarred and pitted with the residue of battle, the tech adepts still patching it up after the fight against the mega-arachnid. Nevertheless, it was a magnificent and humbling sight, though not one that could dull the ache in his head and the churning in his belly from too much Amasek the night before. Giant rumbling cranes suspended from the ceiling lifted massive hoppers of shells and long, snub-nosed missiles into the launch bays of the Titan's weapon mounts. Each gun was the size of a hab block, massive rotary cannons, long-range howitzers, and a monstrous plasma cannon with the power to level cities. He watched the ordnance crews prep the weapons, feeling the familiar flush of pride and excitement as he made his way towards the Titan, and smiled at the obvious masculine symbolism of a Titan being made ready for war. He jumped as a gurney laden with Vulcan bolter shells sped past him, just barely avoiding him as it negotiated its way at speed through the organized chaos of ground personnel, Titan crews and deckhands. It squealed to a halt, and the driver's head snapped around. "Watch where the hell you're going, you damn fool!" shouted the driver, rising from his seat and striding angrily towards him. "You Titan crewmen think you can swan about like pirates. Well, this is my—" The words died in the man's throat, and he snapped to attention as he saw the garnet studs and the winged skull emblem on the shoulder boards of Jonah's uniform jacket that marked him as a Moderati Primus of the Deus Irae. "Sorry," smiled Jonah, spreading his arms in a gesture of amused apology, as he watched the man fight the urge to say more. "Didn't see you there, Chief. Got a hell of a hangover. Anyway, what the devil are you doing driving so fast? You could have killed me."
"You just walked out in front of me, sir," said the man, staring fixedly at a point just over Jonah's shoulder.
"Did I?
Well, just be more careful next time," said Jonah, already walking away. "And watch where you're going," hissed the man under his breath, before climbing back onto his gurney and driving off.
"You be careful now," Jonah called after the driver, imagining the colourful insults the man would already be cooking up about those damned Titan crewmen to tell his fellow ground staff.
The hangar, though over 2 kilometres in length, felt cramped to Jonah as he made his way towards the Deus Irae. The scent of engine oil, grease and sweat not helping one whit with his hangover. A host of battle titans of the Legio Mortis stood ready for war. Fast, mid-range reavers, snarling warhounds and the mighty warlords, as well as some newer knight-gaunt-class titans. But none could match the awesome splendor of an Imperator-class titan. The Deus Irae dwarfed them all in size, power, and magnificence, and Jonah knew there was nothing in the galaxy that could stand against such a terrifying war machine. Jonah adjusted his collar and fastened the brass buttons of his jacket, straightening it over his stocky frame before he reached the Titan's wide feet. He ran his hands through his shoulder-length black hair, trying to give the impression, at least, that he hadn't slept in his clothes. He could see the thin, angular form of Titus Kassar, his fellow Moderati Primus, working behind a monitoring terminal, and had no wish to endure another lecture on the 99 virtues of the Emperor. Apparently, smartness of appearance was one of the most important. "Good morning, Titus," he said, keeping his tone light. Kassar's head bobbed up in surprise, and he quickly slid a folded pamphlet beneath a sheaf of readiness reports. "You're late," he said, recovering quickly. "Reveille was an hour ago, and punctuality is the hallmark of the pious man."
"Don't stop with me, Titus," said Jonah,
reaching over and snatching the pamphlet that Kassar had been so quick to conceal. Kassar made to stop him, but Jonah was too quick, brandishing the pamphlet before him.
"If Princeps Turnit catches you reading this, you'll be a gunnery servitor before you know what's hit you."
"Give it back, Jonah, please."
"I'm not in the mood for another sermon from this damned Lectitio Divinitatis chapbook."
"Fine, I'll put it away. Just give it back, all right?"
Jonah nodded and held the well-thumbed paper out to Kassar, who snatched it back and quickly slid it inside his uniform jacket. Rubbing his temples with the heel of his palms, Jonah said,
"Anyway, what's the rush? It's not as though the old girl's even ready for the pre-deployment checks, is she?"
"I pray you'll stop referring to it as a she, Jonah. It smacks of pagan anthropomorphizing," said Kassar. "A Titan is a war machine, nothing more. Steel, adamantine, and plasma, with flesh and blood controlling it."
"How can you say that?" asked Arukan,
sauntering over to a steel-plated leg section and climbing the steps to the arched gates that led within. He slapped his palm on the thick metal and said,
"She's obviously a she, Titus. Look at the shapely legs, the curve of the hips. And doesn't she carry us within her like a mother protecting her unborn children?"
"In mockery are the seeds of impiety sown," said Kassar, without a trace of irony. "And I will not have it."
"Oh, come on, Titus," said Arukan,
warming to his theme.
"Don't you feel it when you're inside her? Don't you hear the beat of her heart in the rumble of her reactor, or feel the fury of her wrath in the roar of her guns?"
Kassar turned back to the monitoring panel and said,
"No, I do not. And I do not wish to hear any more of your foolishness. We are already behind on our pre-deployment checks. Princeps Turnit will have our hides nailed to the hull if we are not ready."
"Where is the Princeps?"
asked Jonah, suddenly serious.
"With the War Council," said Kassar.
Arukan nodded and descended the steps of the Titan's foot, joining Kassar at the monitoring station and letting fly with one last jibe.
"Just because you've never had the chance to enjoy a woman doesn't mean I'm not right."
Kassar gave him a withering glare and said,
"Enough! The War Council will be done soon, and I'll not have it said that the Legio Mortis wasn't ready to do the Emperor's bidding."
"You mean Horus's bidding," corrected Jonah.
"We have been over this before, my friend," said Kassar. "Horus's authority comes from the Emperor. We forget that at our peril."
"That's as maybe. But it's been many a dark and bloody day since we fought with the Emperor beside us, hasn't it? But hasn't Horus always been there for us on every battlefield?"
"Indeed he has. And for that I'd follow him into battle beyond the Halo Stars,"
nodded Kassar.
"But even the War Master has to answer to the God Emperor."
"God Emperor?"
hissed Jonah, leaning in close as he saw a number of the ground crew turn their heads towards them.
"Listen, Titus. You have to stop this God Emperor rubbish. One day, you're going to say that to the wrong person, and you'll get your skull cracked open. Besides, even the Emperor himself says he's not a god."
"Only the truly divine deny their divinity,"
said Kassar, quoting from his book. Jonah raised his hands in surrender and said,
"All right, have it your way, Titus. But don't say I didn't warn you."
"The righteous have nothing to fear from the wicked, and—"
"Spare me another lesson on ethics, Titus," sighed Jonah, turning away and watching as a detachment of Imperial Army soldiers marched into the hangar, las rifles on canvas slings hanging from their shoulders.
"Any word yet on what we're going to be fighting on this rock?"
asked Jonah, changing the subject.
"I hope it's the Greenskin. We still owe them for the destruction of Vulcus Tor on Ulanor. Do you think it will be the Greenskin?"
Kassar shrugged.
"I don't know, Jonah. Does it matter? We fight who we are ordered to fight."
"I'd just like to know."
"You will know when Princeps Turnit returns," said Kassar, Speaking of which, hadn't you better prepare the command deck for his return?
Jonah nodded, knowing that his fellow moderati was right, and that he'd wasted enough time in baiting him.
Senior Princeps Esau Turnit's reputation as a feared, ruthless warrior was well-deserved, and he ran a tight ship on the Dies Irae.
Titan crews might be permitted more leeway in their behavior than the common soldiery, but Turnit brooked no such laxity in the crew of his Titan.
You're right, Titus. I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry,
said Kassar, pointing to the gateway in the Titan's leg.
Be ready.
Jonah sketched a quick salute and jogged up the steps, leaving Kassar to finish prepping the Titan for refueling. He made his way past embarking soldiers who grumbled as he pushed them aside. Some raised their voices, but upon seeing his uniform and knowing that their lives might soon depend on him, they quickly silenced their objections. Jonah halted at the entrance to the Titan, taking a second to savor the moment as he stood at the threshold. He tilted his head back and looked up at the height of the soaring machine, taking a deep breath as he passed through the tall, eagle and lightning bolt-wreathed gateway and entered the Titan. He was bathed in red light as he entered the cold, hard interior of the Titan and began threading his way through the low-ceilinged corridors with a familiarity born of countless hours learning the position of every rivet and bolt that held the Dies Irae together. There wasn't a corner of the Titan that Jonah didn't know. Every passageway, every hatch, and every secret the old girl had in her belonged to him. Even Titus and Princeps Turnit didn't know the Dies Irae as well as he did. Reaching the end of a narrow corridor, Jonah approached a thick iron door guarded by two soldiers in burnished black breastplates over silver mail shirts. Each wore a mask fashioned in the shape of the Legio's death's head and was armed with a short jolt stick and a holstered shock pistol. They tensed as he came into view, but relaxed a fraction as they recognized him. Jonah nodded to the soldiers and said,
Moderati Primus, moving from lower levels to mid-levels.
The nearest soldier nodded and indicated a glassy black panel beside the door as the other drew his pistol. Its muzzle was slightly flared, and two silver steel prongs protruded threateningly, sparks of blue light flickering between them. Arcs of light could leap out and sear the flesh from a man's bones in a burst of lightning, but wouldn't dangerously ricochet in the cramped confines of a Titan's interior. Jonah pressed his palm against the panel and waited as the yellow beam scanned his hand. A light above the door flashed green, and the nearest soldier reached over and turned a hatch wheel that opened the door.
Thanks, said Jonah, and passed through,
finding himself in one of the screw stairs that climbed the inside of the Titan's leg. The narrow iron mesh stairs curled around thick, fiber-bundle muscles and throbbing power cables, wreathed in a shimmering energy field. But Jonah paid them no mind, too intent on his roiling stomach as he climbed the hot, stuffy stairs. He had to pause to catch his breath halfway up and wiped a hand across his sweaty brow before reaching the next level. This high up, the air was cooler as powerful recycle units dispersed the heat generated by the venting of plasma gases from the reactor. Hooded adepts of the Mechanicum tended to flickering control panels as they carefully built up the plasma levels in the reactor. Crewmen passed him along the cramped confines of the Titan's interior, saluting as they passed him. Good men crewed the Dies Irae. They had to be good. Princeps Turnit would never have picked them otherwise. All the men and women on board the Titan had been chosen personally for their expertise and dedication. Eventually, Jonah reached the Moderati chambers in the heart of the Titan and slid his authenticator into the slot beside the door.
Moderati Primus Jonah Arukan, he said.
The lock mechanism clicked, and with a chime, the door slid open. Inside was a brilliant domed chamber with curving walls of shining metal and half a dozen openings spaced evenly throughout the ceiling. Jonah stood in the center of the room and said,
Come on, Bridge. Moderati Primus Jonah Arukan.
The floor beneath him shimmered and rippled like mercury, a perfectly circular disc of mirror-like metal forming beneath his feet and lifting him from the ground. The thin disc climbed into the air, and Jonah rose through a hole in the ceiling, passing along the transport tube towards the summit of the Titan. The walls of the tube glowed with their own inner light, and Jonah stifled a yawn as the silver disc came to a halt, and he emerged onto the command deck. The interior of the Dies Irae's head section was wide and flat, with recessed bays in the floor to either side of the main gangway, where hooded adepts and servitors interfaced directly with the deep core functions of the colossal machine.
"And how is everyone this fine morning?"
he asked no one in particular.
"Ready to take the fight to the heathens once more?"
As usual, no one answered him, and Jonah shook his head with a smile as he made his way to the front of the bridge, already feeling his hangover receding at the thought of meshing with the command interface. Three padded chairs occupied a raised dais before the glowing green tactical viewer, each with thick bundles of insulated cables trailing from the arms and headrests. He slid past the central chair, that of Princeps Turnit, and sat in the chair to the right, sliding into the comfortable groove he'd worn in the creaking leather over the years.
"Adepts," he said, "link me."
Red-robed adepts of the Mechanicum appeared, one on either side of him, their movements slow and in perfect concert with one another, and slotted fine microcellular gauntlets over his hands, the inner mnemonic surfaces meshing with his skin and registering his vital signs. Another adept lowered a silver lattice of encephalographic sensors onto his head, and the touch of the cool metal against his skin was a welcome sensation. "Hold still, Moderati," said the adept behind him, his voice dull and lifeless. "The cortical dendrites are ready to deploy." Jonah heard the hiss of the neck clamps as they slid from the side of the headrest, and, from the corners of his eyes, he could see slithering slivers of metal emerging from the clamps. He braced himself for the momentary pain of connection as they slid across his cheek like silver worms reaching towards his eyes. Then he could see them fully. Incredibly fine silver wires, each no thicker than a human hair, yet capable of carrying vast amounts of information. The clamps gripped his head firmly as the silver wires descended and penetrated the corners of his eyes, worming down past his optic nerve and into his brain, where they finally interfaced directly with his cerebral cortex. He grunted as the momentary icy pain of connection passed through his brain, but relaxed as he felt the body of the Titan become one with his own. Information flooded through him, the cortical dendrites filtering it through portions of his brain that normally went unused, allowing him to feel every part of the gigantic machine as though it were an extension of his own flesh. Within microseconds, the post-hypnotic implants in the subconscious portions of his brain were already running the pre-deployment checks, and the insides of his eyeballs lit up with telemetry data, weapon readiness status, fuel levels, and a million other nuggets of information that would allow him to command this beautiful, wonderful Titan. "How do you feel?" asked the adept, and Jonah laughed.
"It's good to be the king," he said.
As the first pinpricks of light flared in the sky, Akshub knew that history had come to her world. She gripped her fetish-hung staff directly in her clawed hand, knowing that a moment in time had dawned that mankind would never forget, heralding a day when the gods themselves would step from myth and legend to hammer out the future in blood and fire. She had waited for this day, since the great warriors from the sky had brought word of the sacred task appointed to her when she was little more than a babe in arms. As the great red orb of the sun rose in the north, hot, dry winds brought the sour fragrance of bitter blossoms from the tomb-littered valleys of long-dead emperors. Standing high in the mountains, she watched this day of days unfold below her, tears of rapture spilling down her wrinkled cheeks from her black, oval eyes, as the pinpricks of light became fiery trails, streaking across the clouds towards the ground. Below her, great herds of horned beasts trekked across the verdant savanna, sweeping towards their watering holes in the south, before the day grew too hot for them to move, and the swift, razor-fanged predators emerged from their rocky burrows. Flocks of wide, pinioned birds wheeled over the highest peaks of the mountains above her, their cries raucous yet musical,
as this momentous day grew older. All the multitudinous varieties of life carried on in their usual ways, oblivious to the fact that events that would change the fate of the galaxy were soon to unfold on this unremarkable world. On this day of days, only she truly appreciated it. The first wave of drop pods landed around the central massif at exactly 16:04 Zulu time, the screaming jets of their retros bringing them in on fiery pillars as they breached the lower atmosphere. Stormbirds followed, like dangerously graceful birds of prey, swooping in on some hapless victim. Black and scorched by the heat of re-entry, the 30 drop pods sent up great clouds of dust and earth from their impacts, their wide doors opening with percussive booms and clanging down on the step. 300 warriors in thick plate armor swiftly disembarked from the drop pods and fanned out with mechanical precision, quickly linking up with other squads and forming a defensive perimeter around an unremarkable patch of ground in the center of their landing pattern. Stormbirds circled above in overlapping racetrack patterns, as though daring anything to approach. At some unseen signal, the Stormbirds broke formation and rose into the sky as the boxy form of a thunderhawk descended from the clouds, its belly blackened and trailing blue-white contrails. The larger craft surrounded the smaller one, like mother hens protecting a chick, escorting it to the surface, where it landed in a billowing cloud of red dust. The Stormbirds screamed away on prescribed patrol circuits as the forward ramp of the Thunderhawk groaned open, the hiss of pressurized air gusting from within. 10 warriors, clad in the comb-crested helms and shimmering plate armor of the Sons of Horus, marched from the gunship, cloaks of many colors billowing at their shoulders. Each carried a golden bolter across his chest, and their heads turned from left to right as they searched for threats. Behind them came a living god, his armor gleaming gold and ocean green, with a cloak of regal purple framing him perfectly. A single carved red eye stared out from his breastplate, and a wreath of laurels sat upon his perfect brow.
"Davin," sighed Horus, "I never thought I'd see this place again."